I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight.
In order to get a city of Philadelphia that works for all, we're going to have to work together, stand together.
Protesters are out in force again this evening, 1 week after two black men were arrested in a Philadelphia Starbucks. The incident gained national attention for what many saw as a prime example of racial bias. WHYY's Joe Hernandez is following the story and joins me now. Joe, why don't we start with what got us here, starting last Thursday?
Right. So last Thursday, two men, Rashawn Nelson and Dante Robinson, walked into the Starbucks in Rittenhouse Square. Both Nelson and Robinson are black. According to the police report, they asked to use the bathroom, but were told that was for customers only. They hadn't bought anything in the Starbucks. They were going there for a business meeting and waiting for a third man. So apparently they were asked to leave. They refused, and that's when the manager called 911. Police arrived and talked with Nelson and Robinson and then arrested them. And the incident, as you mentioned, Dave, has gotten national attention for what many people say is race-based discrimination against these two.
Philadelphia Police Commissioner Richard Ross initially defended his corps, but today he apologized, in fact, saying he failed miserably. Joe, why the about-face from defending the officers just a few days ago?
Well, at first, right, Ross did defend the officers. He said they did absolutely nothing wrong at all. But since then, he's backtracked. He says he learned about this policy at Starbucks, which many of us understand that you can go in there and hang out. You don't necessarily have to buy something right away. And he said at first he didn't choose his words carefully in his initial response.
For starters, I should have said the officers acted within the scope of the law and not that they didn't do anything wrong. Words are very important. While it is no excuse, my lack of awareness of the Starbucks business model played a role in my messaging.
Joe, you're joining us after returning from across the street at police headquarters where protesters began their march over these arrests at Starbucks. What's their contention?
Well, the protest was held by Power, which is a faith-based organization in Philadelphia and southeastern Pennsylvania, and they had three demands. One, that Philadelphia pay for body cameras for all cops in the next 12 months. Two, that the city increase funding for the Police Advisory Commission. And three, that the city, they say the city should follow the lead of Starbucks and retrain all police officers in implicit bias and de-escalation techniques, which Starbucks is going to do that next month. The group did praise Ross for his apology for his about face, but Rabbi Sean Zevit of Mishkan Shalom in Manayunk said the power really lies with rank and file officers.
We're asking individual officers to really see the breadth and depth of their power in that moment and to not buy into that system, even if that phone call has been made and said, oh, now I must follow through to the most extreme end because I'm, quote, fulfilling my duty, rather to be someone who can assess, discern in a situation and guide it and de-escalate it.
Mayor Jim Kenney just tonight issued a statement saying he acknowledged the pain of these two men and updated people on investigations that are ongoing with the Police Advisory Commission, with the Internal Affairs Bureau at the Police Department, and with the Philadelphia Commission on Human Relations as well.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
WHYY's Joe Hernandez on NewsWorks Tonight. A Philadelphia judge has sentenced Liberian warlord Mohamed Jabate to 30 years in prison for lying to U.S. immigration officials about his violent past. WHYY's Aaron Moselle reports.
Jabate's sentence far exceeds federal guidelines for someone convicted of immigration fraud and perjury. Prosecutors said there's a reason. Jabate isn't guideline material, not even close. William McSwain is U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Pennsylvania.
He participated in and he ordered rapes, sexual enslavement, slave labor, murder, mutilation, and ritual cannibalism, and he utilized child soldiers throughout.
The man who's lived in Delaware County for about two decades wasn't convicted of those crimes, allegedly committed as a rebel commander during Liberia's first civil war. Jabate was arrested after federal agents discovered he lied about that past on immigration paperwork, first while he was seeking asylum in the U.S. and again when he was getting his green card. McSwain says that makes this a historic case.
What we've essentially done is set up a mechanism here in the Eastern District of Pennsylvania to hold war criminals accountable when they seek safe haven in the United States by lying to the immigration authorities.
Jabate, known in Liberia as General Jungle Jabba, showed no emotion as U.S. District Judge Paul Diamond handed him what could easily be a life sentence. And when given the chance, the 51-year-old father told the judge he had nothing to say about his crimes or the atrocities that ripped his country apart. Prosecutors said they expect Jabate to appeal. Aaron Moselle, WHYY News.
Philadelphia's smog problem gets worse, says American Lung Association. Let's look beyond that headline in this week's Philadelphia Inquirer with Dr. Marilyn Howarth, occupational and environmental medicine physician who works with the Center of Excellence in Environmental Toxicology at the Perelman School of Medicine. Dr. Howarth, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks tonight.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Now, smog is the same thing as ground-level ozone, but whatever you call it, what is it?
It is a secondary pollutant. It's not something that comes out of any smokestack anywhere, but it's a combination of all of the kinds of pollutants that you would normally see coming out of a smokestack. So in the presence of sunlight, you have nitrogen oxides that come from tailpipes of vehicles, and you have volatile organic chemicals. These are the chemicals that tend to come into the air and want to be airborne. And they generally come from places like the refinery. And when you, in the presence of sunlight, you have a mixture of those nitrogen oxides and those volatile organics, you make ozone. And that's why our ozone is high in the summer months.
And then there's a threshold by which a day is determined to be unhealthy.
Yes. The EPA every day measures pollutants in the air, and they put out the air quality index. Sometimes news organizations actually report this, and in fact, people can sign up for it every day at airnow.gov if they're interested. It reports whether the air quality is good or needs to be better, is a problem for vulnerable populations, children with asthma, or other people with health effects.
This is the Lung Association's 19th annual air quality rankings. And to assess Philadelphia's smog problem is getting worse, is it marginally worse, much worse, and how does it compare with other major metropolitan areas?
Unfortunately, Philadelphia is in the middle of an economic upturn in the sense that we have a lot of building, a lot of activity, and we still, in the middle of our city, have an airport and also a refinery. And as we increase the number of cars, we still have these other pollutants that add together to worsen our air pollution and the state of our air cumulatively. So in terms of other cities, we are unfortunately in the top group of worst air quality for major cities, and that is directly impacting the health of our citizens.
To what extent, though, does particle pollution play into this, and how is that differentiated from ground ozone?
Particle pollution is really a combination of chemicals that tend to adhere or glom on, if you will, to particles that we might think of as soot. Anything that burns creates particle pollution, but some of those particles are more hazardous than others. Some of them contain actual carcinogens and other kinds of toxic chemicals. And so the level of particulate in our air is very important to our health. The particulate level in Philadelphia has been improving. And in fact, for the very first time in the fall of 2017, the city of Philadelphia was actually in compliance with federal standards.
Is that in part due to the diminishment of, for example, coal-fired plants?
Well, we in Philadelphia are the unfortunate recipient of the air that comes from western Pennsylvania and Ohio. And there are so many coal-fired power plants that dirty air finds its way to Philadelphia and unfortunately will be the source of ongoing particulate pollution on an ongoing basis. No, I think rather than any diminishment in coal regionally, I think it may be due to other factors that have controlled some particulate.
Dr. Howarth, thanks so much for perspective on the latest American Lung Association annual air quality ranking.
You're welcome. Glad to talk with you.
Dr. Marilyn Howarth, occupational and environmental medicine physician, also working with the Center of Excellence in Environmental Toxicology at the Perelman School of Medicine. Nuclear power plants around the country are shutting down. 20 reactors are already on their way out, and several more are expected to follow. Though questions remain about what to do with the nuclear waste. A federal plan to store it at Yucca Mountain in Nevada has been scrapped. Oyster Creek Nuclear Plant in Lacey Township, New Jersey, will retire in October. State Impact Pennsylvania's Catalina Jaramillo reports that the community is facing an uncertain future, but they have a proposal. Pay them for storing radioactive waste.
Lacey's municipal building is packed for the town's bi-weekly meeting, and even the mayor is surprised.
I'd like to say this is the first time I've had a full house like this. It really feels great.
People are here to find out what happens next October when the nuclear plant shuts down for good. Excellence Oyster Creek Nuclear Generating Station sits alongside Barnegat Bay in Ocean County, and it has served as the town's main economic driver for 50 years. Richard Rom lives in a nearby senior housing complex, and he's worried.
Is it going to bring the town down as far as, you know, more empty houses and stuff like that, lost business and stuff like that? I'm concerned.
About 500 people work at the plant. More than half will keep their jobs during the several years it will take to clean up the plant. But there's way more at stake than jobs. Residents like Rom benefit from the plant even if they don't work there. The plant pays Lacey almost $2.7 million in taxes, and the town gets more than $11 million each year in property tax relief. That means homeowners like Rom save $2,000 to $3,000 a year compared to those living in neighboring counties. Regina DiSenza says her family moved to Lacey 20 years ago because of the low taxes.
That was really, I think, the whole attraction to this community to begin with.
Now, she's worried taxes will go up, people will move out, and property values will drop. But Lacey is not only losing the economic benefits from hosting the nuclear plant. They will be stuck with 753 metric tons of nuclear waste that will be left behind because there's no federal plan to dispose of it. Gary Quinn is Lacey's former mayor and a current committeeman. He says the town never anticipated having to deal with nuclear waste. The spent nuclear fuel rods stay radioactive for hundreds of thousands of years.
When it was first built, it was never agreed upon that it would become a spent fuel storage facility, which going forward at this point in time appears to be what we're facing.
That's because the Department of Energy failed to make good on their commitment to remove radioactive waste from the nation's nuclear plants. For more than 10 years, the federal government collected billions of dollars from plant owners and ratepayers to pay for permanent storage. But the plan to bury it underground at Yucca Mountain in Nevada never happened. Currently, the federal government pays plant owners like Exelon for the cost of keeping the nuclear waste. Quinn says the host communities also deserve to get paid.
Our feeling is, you know, and we spoke to other municipalities throughout the state that are host, you know, communities to these facilities, that if we're going to be keeping this fuel in our town, we certainly should be receiving some of the compensation that is currently being paid by every single, you know, ratepayer to the electric companies throughout the country.
Quinn says there's no way to replace the shuttered nuclear plant with any other business. Even if Exelon cleans the site as they are required to do, no one wants nuclear waste in their backyard.
It would be very difficult to build any kind of a major, you know, whether it be residential or commercial, any kind of, you know, development on a site where you have concrete casks sitting next to the parking lot that are storing spent fuel. You know, it just doesn't work.
Christina Simeon is a nuclear energy expert from the University of Pennsylvania. She says the federal government should be paying communities like Lacey some kind of rent.
I think the communities are getting shortchanged because the nuclear plant operators are getting compensated from the federal government for their investments in building the infrastructure needed to safely store the waste on site. But the communities are not getting paid for their services as waste host communities.
Simeon says this is a growing problem nationwide.
It's very surprising that there's not a discussion about the waste that's accumulating on these sites.
There is a bill in Congress that would authorize federal funds to pay communities like Lacey to store the nuclear waste, but it hasn't gained any traction. Two communities actually negotiated payments directly from the plant owners, and two other towns have offered to keep the nation's waste for a price. Quinn says if the original plan to store the nuclear waste in Nevada is not happening, then the money should go to the de facto storage sites, like Lacey Township.
Why is it that billions of dollars were spent in the state of Nevada, you know, to be able to build this thing and to be able to store this material safely, whereas every other community throughout the country that is doing the Nevada job now has received no compensation whatsoever?
But right now, there's no guarantee the town will get anything but the radioactive waste, which sits in a concrete structure in a parking lot 5 miles from the beach. Catalina Jaramillo, WHYY News.
In April, not many people have the mummers on their minds, but photographer Andrea Modica is not the typical mummers photographer. Today, she's releasing a book of photographs shot over a 10-year period called January 1, featuring formal black-and-white portraits of wenches taken on 2 Street immediately after the annual New Year's Day parade. She uses a century-old camera technique, using a large-format camera that can only hold one negative at a time. WHYY's Peter Crimmins spoke with Modica about her unusual approach to mummery.
As a reporter, I have covered the mummers a few times, and there's always one shot that everyone gets, that everybody who's ever covered the mummers parade gets that shot, where they're parading up Broad Street, and you stand on the median strip in the middle of Broad Street as the mummers file past you on either side, and you get as wide a shot as you can. You maybe use a wide-angle lens, and you get that shot. Everyone gets that shot. I've done that shot.
I never got that shot.
But you don't. That's not the shot you were going for.
Well, I didn't necessarily want to get anything. I wanted to see what there was to get, you see. I just went there with tremendous curiosity as a newcomer to Philadelphia. Oh, probably about 10 years ago, 11 years ago, January 1st rolled along, and I saw these men in dresses on 2 Street, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is really interesting. So I brought my camera, which is an 8x10 view camera, which is quite a large camera, which is key to the way the pictures look. The camera's on a tripod. It's large. It's heavy. It's a very slow process. It's a collaborative process. Camera requires that you set up the composition and then close the lens and put the film holder in and take the slide out and then take the picture. So there are some minutes involved where things unfold.
That shot that I'm describing that everyone gets up standing on the median strip, it's an action shot. It's full of color. It's people marching and moving and parading, and you've removed them from that. And you shot them black and white, printed in a platinum print, which is a very sort of classic 19th century technique. It's strikingly different from how we normally see pictures of mummers.
These are not documentary pictures. They're not necessarily factual. They really are about me, and they are about the wenches, and they're about what unfolds during that time we are together. Mm-hmm.
I wonder what your initial attraction was to the mummers. You started photographing them when you just moved to town, and so if at first blush, it was this weird thing that happens in Philadelphia every New Year's Day. What made you want to get in there and, you know, get inside?
I should say I probably started, as I start every project, as a tourist, as an outsider who doesn't quite understand what's going on. And of course, you know, I can read, I can talk to people, but photographing is such an intimate project, photographing in this manner. I kind of cut to the chase. That's just, very seductive. I just want to do that over and over again. I went to 2 Street. I saw men in dresses that they call suits, by the way. And I felt excluded, you see. First of all, because the groups that I photograph primarily are entirely male. So I, you know, chipping away, saw much more than the outfits and the male culture, and start to find myself there in terms of the human qualities you can see, I hope, in the portraits.
What you're making is—it's not a document of these people. It's something that was created in the moment, in the minutes that it takes to make the picture.
Yeah,
you're kind of telling us the story of those minutes that it took to
right.
take the picture.
I'll give you one example of how something really beautiful unfolded this year in 2018. I saw a little boy who was just precious, probably 3 years old, in, you know, full female garb. And I asked his parents, I could photograph him, and stood him in front of the camera. And you might recall this was a particularly cold year. The boy was shivering, so his father, Motorcycle Bob was his name, why don't you just, you know, go in there and put your arm around him. And the father was so gigantic next to this boy, and he just enveloped him in this absolutely, you know, loving, beautiful embrace in a dress, two dresses. And then he's got a tattoo on top of his shaven head and this, you know, slightly intense look, like this could turn bad. So there's a combination of different meanings within the single image, true or false. It doesn't matter to me if these things are true. But this is the fiction that's created in the picture as a result of using this equipment.
I'm speaking with Andrea Modica. Her new book is January 1. It's 10 years of taking pictures of the mummers on New Year's Day. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you, Peter.
Andrea Modica spoke with WHYY's Peter Crimmins. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. NewsWorks Tonight.